Hello, welcome to Dark Materials. I'm Faye.
Hi.
And I'm Rachel. Hello.
This is usually a podcast where we're reading through and discussing Philip Pullman's, his Dark Materials novels, a chapter at a time, spoiler free.
But in this very special episode, we are interviewing Brian Fisher, who is LMP himself and one of the lead puppeteers on the His Dark Materials TV series.
This episode contains spoilers for the Amber Spyglass book and the TV series, so if you've not read or watched both, please come back when you're all caught up. Hi.
Hello. Hello, hello, hello.
Hello. It has been a hot minute.
A hot minute. We were forging ahead. All systems going, happily working our way through the TV series, through all of our interviews. And then all of a sudden, life threw some curveballs at us and we had to just take a little step back. So that is why you've not had the last episode of the TV series from us yet.
Yep. You will be getting it. We're not going anywhere. We're still going to be around. We're still going to finish the books. I don't want any of you to think that we are not going to carry on with the pod.
We did threaten in the episode 7 that we were going to stop the podcast and never do episode 8. And then we actually might have scared people.
Yeah.
We will do episode 8.
We definitely will.
When the dust has settled a little. Oh, the dust. And we're able to get back to it. So, yes.
Exactly, yeah. We're still going to be around. We just had, sometimes life gets in the way. That's what's happened. But we are excited for this episode because we've been teasing it for ages. We have spoken to our pal, our friend, Brian
official
Fisher.
Pal.
The official pal. Official pal that we have a little WhatsApp chat with, and it's great.
Yes. We saw Brian in person a few weeks ago. If you check our Instagram stories, you'll see it in one of the highlights. We went and saw Brian in person at the Creature exhibition in Cardiff. And it was lovely to see him again. And we had to apologise to him in person and be like, Brian, we're so sorry. We recorded your episode weeks ago. We've still not aired it. And then we've made him wait a few more weeks after that even. So
We did. But
this
is
finally it.
Yeah. It was lovely to see Brian in person and all of the puppet crew as well. And that exhibition was amazing.
It was so lovely.
But yeah, I loved chatting to Brian so much. This interview is so great and we spoke for a long time. So thank you to Brian for his time. We went well over the time that we were supposed to chat to him.
Absolutely. I will put in, because when I was editing, I was like, I know we love this kind of stuff, Faye, but is this too much for the podcast? I will give you all a warning that when we ask Brian about how he broke his arm and was working with a broken arm on set, that his story is quite medically graphic.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're a little bit squeamish or you don't deal well with anything to do with car accidents or hospitals, maybe just skip forward through that section because it is quite intense. It's, oh my gosh, what a story. But that's just a little warning for you there if you're a bit squeamish.
Good warning. I love that kind of stuff. I really love those kind of medical stories. So when Rach messaged me being like, should we take that out? I was like, no, it's so great. But totally understand there are people that do not want to hear that kind of stuff. So good warning. That is a good warning.
Yeah. That's probably the biggest tangent we take away from stuff on the show.
Yeah, I mean, it's still related to the show.
And it's still very related to the show. It happened while they were filming.
Yeah. So without further ado, we will get into this interview with Brian Fisher and we hope that you enjoy it as much as we enjoyed talking to Brian.
Yes.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello.
Hi. It's me. Hi.
It's you. We're so excited. Yes, love that. We're kicking off with a Taylor Swift lyric.
With some tea time,
We're so excited to have you. Honestly, we talk about you all the time, Brian. We're your biggest fan. We're just we can't wait to speak to Brian. So yes, we have been waiting for this for a long time.
It's finally happening.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've been waiting for this as well, so don't worry, it's mutual.
Yay! Okay, so let's get into it. First question. You have done 3 whole seasons on His Dark Materials, and now it's done. How are you feeling at the end of like such a long journey?
It's really hard to put into words. I think Russ and I were literally talking yesterday about how there's kind of just a hole now. And this, I mean, it's been over a year that we've been done. That we've been done with principal shooting. Obviously, there's all of the press and stuff that has happened afterwards, but we are now completely done. And it makes me a bit a bit jittery to talk about, because it happened very suddenly for me, especially. I was thrown into it, kind of held on by the seat of my pants, had an incredible time throughout, and then before we all knew it, it was just done. So I think it's been such a beautiful show to work on, so many incredible people. It really has been a family more than any show I've ever worked on. It's also the longest term project I've ever gone straight from beginning to end with. And it's a bit, it's a bit devastating, I think. And the third season has been such an incredible season. I think it's my favorite out of all three, to be honest. I think it really came together in a fantastic way. So it's kind of even more devastating, because if it hadn't been as good, it would be like, oh, well, you know, well, what a good show. But it was just so good that it was really heartbreaking to watch over and over and over again, because I have watched it all multiple times now. And it's been kind of therapy trying to go, yes, it happened. Yes, it's done. Yes, it's okay. Yes, it's fantastic. Great.
Yeah. It's sad. It's sad that it's done. We feel the same.
I feel quite a lot like Monkey in terms of his journey. I think that's somehow I managed to mirror that journey within my own time on the show, mm-hmm. minus the abuse, but well.
Hopefully, yeah.
Well, no.
Speaking of, you said you kind of just like were thrown in at the deep end with getting involved in the project. Could you tell us about that journey of how you first got started with the project, how you got involved? And also, I guess, as a part of that, what your role involves, and like just so that people that are listening kind of understand exactly what it is, because a lot of people have seen the puppets on social media, they've seen clips of you and what you do, but they perhaps don't understand exactly what your role is. So it would be great to kind of flesh that out for everyone.
Yeah, even when we go and meet and interact with people who are massive fans of the books and then the shows subsequently, they still will ask some of the strangest questions about the puppets, and they're like, oh no, we've seen all the behind the scenes. But like, but why is the puppet here? Or like, but why do you use it? What is the puppet? What? And you're like, okay, fine. And it's a great opportunity to actually bring it up and explain it. So I'll try and do it briefly. First, I'll go through how I got onto the project. Mm-hmm. So I'm a self-employed freelance person. I essentially am an artist rather than this has changed over the last few years, but I began when the show was beginning as an artist, principally as a puppeteer, coming from acting. And so I looked for jobs myself. So I would look around at projects I knew were kind of coming up, or I would hear little whispers of this happening, or, you know, ooh, this stage show is happening, or a friend had helped build something. Ooh, that's interesting. I'd found an article about His Dark Materials being possibly made. And I thought, that would be a really lovely one for puppets. I don't know if they'll use real puppets or if they'll incorporate them in a sort of hybrid way, or if it's VFX. I just don't know. So I'll start writing off to people that I think might be involved. And I kind of did some emails here, there, and everywhere and heard nothing back. And I thought, that's fine. Project has not gone my way, or they're going a different... You can never know. So that's fine. It was just stabbing in the dark. And then I was out at a park in London having a walk with my dog and got a phone call, and my agent was like, do you want to go in and do this reading for this show? And I was like, okay. She's like, I'm not sure what it is. I can't really tell you anything. Okay. So I went and just decided, fine, I'll go. And I went to Wales. So I took a train out that day to Wales to meet with them the next day, to Cardiff, I should say, and met with them. And they said, yeah, here's this puppet, which I've said before and everyone has heard, was essentially just at that stage a box of like a spray painted orange milk carton with some like dowels that had been broken and stuck together with like twine. And I was like, I'm not sure what's happening here. And they said, right, you've got today to work with this puppet. Here's some scenes. You'll be meeting Tom Hooper tonight. If he likes you, then you'll be meeting Ruth Wilson tomorrow. Okay, just so you know what's going on. And I was like, okay, yes. So I went through, I played with this puppet. I really tried to do the best I could, got in front of Tom Hooper. Luckily, he was a big fan of mine. He just said, he was like, no, I'm not going to do a Tom Hooper impersonation. That's not fair. That's just not fair. He essentially was like, right, can I just do this instead? Okay, in this scene, that makes no sense to me. So why are you doing that? And he was just grilling me completely. And I was just going, well, this is why I think this. And then at one point he said, I want you to come over here. And I said, no. And he was like, why are you saying no? And I said, well, because I think it would be better if I went and did this. But how about I do what you said first and then I do that? And he was like, okay, fine. Yeah, you'll be fine. Then I had to meet with Ruth. That was her coming in from London as well. They basically just wanted to make sure that I wasn't a complete mismatch to her because they knew that we'd have to be working close together. I think the main thing is that they were looking for somebody who could define what the role between the puppeteer and the actors needed to be. They knew that Ruth was into it more than some of the actors were to begin with. And so they wanted somebody that could kind of match her level. So I went in and met with her. I can't say I was nervous, actually. I don't think I had had enough time to be nervous. And I also think I just thought, well, this is my job. And if she's not happy with me, then it's not my job. And that's the bottom line. It will not be the right part for me. So we met, we had a kind of sit down and talk through some of the script stuff, which I had only just gotten that day and read as quickly as I could. She was a very, very kind person, very smart, intelligent, turned on. And I was like, right, okay, this is, I can get on with this person in an artistic way. And then she said, right, I've got a movement person. Let's pretend to be monkeys. So I just kind of jumped into it, showed her some simian stuff. I'd been looking at some documentaries. And we played around the room, literally pretending to be monkeys. And it kind of started snowballing from there. I made sure that she was comfortable with me just being next to her at all times. And she was. And we just didn't stop after that. Literally every day from then on until pretty much the end of filming, we would just every day talk together about what was coming up, what was needing to be rehearsed, what would be useful to think about, what would, you know, oh, Brian, I'm not sure about how to move in this. Can you just give me a color palette, a movement palette of some ideas? And it just kept going, and it just built and built and built over those seasons. So that's what I was brought in to do. Two seconds while my demon,
no worries,
my little dog Thistle is scratching at the door. 2 seconds, hold on.
No, it's all good.
So I think the short version of that is I had a day to come through to Wales, meet with everyone, all the top people, make sure I didn't make a fool of myself, make sure they were happy yelling at me and me taking that. So I was to come in and help define this role between what a puppeteer and an actor could do on the show. And Ruth and I really were the touchstone that a lot of people looked to. When you had new actors coming in, they would kind of see how we were doing it together, and they could either do it that way or be much more hands off. It was every actor was different. So, but we pushed that boundary and then built that relationship with Ross, and you know, the rest is kind of history. Now, in terms of what I ended up doing by the end of the show, I moved through the seasons into a more holistic position, which was then managing the middle ground between what production wanted and what VFX needed to accomplish in the end, and us trying to constantly stay on top of building assets, things, building physical things that we could use on set to accomplish complex visual effect outcomes. So if the monkey is handing over the alethiometer over a couch, taking the alethiometer, then handing it to Mrs. Coulter, the monkey doesn't exist. The only monkey that exists on the day is me crawling around with a monkey puppet, which doesn't have fingers or hands or, you know, it doesn't really have the ability to do that. And if I were to properly puppeteer that, it would then have a massive human. Okay, I'm not that big, but like a big person who they'd have to constantly cut out of every single shot. And if I was crawling over the couch, you'd have footsteps from me. So it causes a lot of problems. So by the end of this whole thing, we were constantly day to day coming up with physical interpretations of how to make those things a reality, how to actually physically pass an alethiometer in the correct way that it would allow the animators to animate through it and still give indentations where his feet might be on the couch, still ruffle, you know, fabric the correct way, still shade things the correct way. So we were, it's a very deep embedded job on a technical side as well as that performance side, which everyone kind of sees the outcome of with how the actors are interacting with their demons. That is them interacting with us every day. So yeah, it was a real sort of middle ground in between a lot of different departments. Gosh, there's so much to go into. I imagine there will be some more specific questions, but I could literally talk forever. I've done like 2 hour, 3 hour masterclasses where I literally just talk the entire time and still feel like I've only just scratched the surface.
Yeah.
I guess with that, what you were saying about how, you know, you're building smaller assets that allow you to do things like pass the alethiometer from hand to hand. We did have one question from one of our listeners or from social media about like how that decision is made and how cautious you had to be when making the decisions of when the demon puppets would touch the actors about, because we know that that's an expensive thing to do in VFX. And like, how much were you involved with that? Were there moments where you were like, but I really think the monkey would touch Coulter in this moment? And they were like, nope, too expensive.
Absolutely. It was a constant fight. There are so many parts of that question that are really, really, really interesting to talk about and how they developed over time. By the end of this, we were doing things that I haven't seen. I haven't seen this level of interaction in a show in anything else I've ever worked on or that I've heard people working on. You have elements of this that are used in different series, but the entire process of what we were doing, I've never seen. And it's something that a lot of us that have done it are trying to take forward, like what Russ and I were talking about, really wanting to take these ideas and these principles forward. But it involves a lot of trust. So let me break it down into a couple of different things. So first of all, deciding what we would be building. So let's say we're just talking in a technical standpoint, not puppets, but technical things that we can build that then they can later CG over. So the alethiometer is a great example, or Mrs. Coulter grabbing onto the monkey, or Lyra laying down against Yorick, or in this third season, the monkey passing a rock to Mrs. Coulter for her passing a rock to the monkey to hit her. So all of those things obviously have a physical outcome that needs to happen. Russ will have broken everything down with VFX. So he oversees the visual effects department. He will have overseen everything, broken it down and said, right, here's how much money we have per this episode, right? We have 1,000,000,000 squibs, right, to spend on this episode. So per shot, he would break it down and say, we see this many demons this many times, we can have this many shots in wide, this many shots in medium, this many shots close up. And then we would say, right, what interaction is there within that scene? So I would know before stepping on set, every single scene, the amount of money that they could afford to spend on the demons and the other visual effects things. So this is where it gets interesting, because you have visual effects supervisors that are on set doing this and keeping an eye on this and making sure they have everything they need. But because I was incorporated into that decision-making process, I was able to know that and then carefully negotiate on set if an actor says, I think my demon should be here. Why am I not seeing my demon more? We can kind of on the fly decide. Now, this is after, don't forget, this is after literally months of sitting around tables and talking and you know, me going up to Russ's office and sitting down and discussing every single shot and, you know, how much we can do. And really, this one, we cannot do more than this. So this is after a lot of pre-work, but just on the day, I'd go in and a good example is, so with Will Keane, he felt that we hadn't seen, what's her name? His little demon.
I can't remember her name. She's the little lizard, isn't she?
Oh, she's so lovely. Oh no. Oh no, forgive me.
I can't remember.
Oh no. Let's just, so for Will Keane, he felt that we hadn't seen enough of his demon, and season three, he was like, I really want to see more of it. And I said, I will do everything I can to fight for it, but I can't promise because we have so many other things happening. I just can't promise, but I will always try and get a puppet pass for you so they have the option. And Russ said, that's totally fine. Just get the puppet passes when you can, make something that you think is reasonable. But no promises. And Will said, that's fine. That's good enough for me. And actually in the final edit, we had a lot more than was originally scripted. Basically, there was zero, almost zero. And we pushed pretty hard to find some really interesting places where she could pop up and make an appearance and actually add to the scene rather than just be there for the sake of being there. So it's those conversations that would constantly be happening day in, day out, shot to shot, minute to minute. All of those negotiations were taking place. And that was a big part of my job, was to negotiate those things and make sure everyone was happy, but also that VFX wasn't going bankrupt, basically. So that's how you kind of decide day to day what's in there. Now, if you have a, this is what I'm saying, it's so technical, it's hard to get through quickly. If you have a, if we know that there's a moment where Monkey is passing something to somebody else, and we know that that's something that's integral, then we would have figured out in advance, say two options or three options of different rigs that we could bring in on the day and use. Sometimes that would be something very specific, and it would be like a little special magic arm. That's I say magic arm as in it's a technical term, a magic arm, not like ooh magic, but like a technical magic arm attached to something, sure. And it would have a swivel on it, and we'd be able to puppeteer it across, and it would give the correct arc of a hand moving through the space. Great, that's good. Sometimes, like the rock, Mrs. Coulter passing the rock to Monkey, we had come up with some options, but on the day it wasn't feeling natural. It just felt too stiff, or it was just too floppy and wasn't holding the weight of this because it was a real rock. So what we did is we put a gray sock on my hand, gray being a nice neutral color, doesn't bounce light, easy to replace. A gray sock on my hand, then was under the frame. I would reach up through the frame with this little gray sock, take the little rock, try and move it in a nice way that Monkey, as if Monkey was taking the weight originally and then shifting it to himself. So I would take the little rock in my little socky hand, move it over to where it needs to go, and then disappear out of shot really quickly. And that way they have a nice clean shot afterwards. So it wasn't always high tech, but it was always very well thought out and what was needed. And sometimes that's a really good option. And then in terms of puppets interacting with people, there are lots of demons that move over clothes. The clothes have to move, otherwise it doesn't feel real. Monkeys going across a couch will leave indentations in cushions, in blankets, etc. So all of those kinds of things we would think about in advance. We would look at the set, we'd talk to the art directors, ask if we could move this paper just sneakily this way, and then they would say, oh, it feels a little bit empty. Well, let's put some writing on the table. There's lots of times in the war room, for example, you saw writing on the table. That's because we had to keep moving papers out of the way so we didn't have demons and Galavespian fluttering papers constantly, which would then have to be digital. So that way there was writing all over the table. It felt very lived in, but those things don't move when we're moving across the space. And then if we have a request for Azrael and Stell to interact with each other, that would be a discussion that I would have had in advance. I would understand how much there was there to play with. And then you find a middle ground that everyone's happy with. Yeah, there are lots of layers to it, but I think this one particularly worked because everyone was open with everyone. And I understood, I'm talking about my department, all of us understood the general requirements, or would come to me and say, how much money, how many shots do we have? Quietly, how many shots do we have? I'd say, you only have three shots, so make them count because you only get those three. And then you have to work that through with directors and help them understand why you can only have three. And you move on from there.
Wow. There's a lot.
Yeah, I'm really sorry. Please,
no, that's amazing. I love how in-depth you've gone.
If the listeners are still here, please hang in there. There's some tea. I'm sure that will come out. This is the technical stuff. I can imagine it feeling very alienating because they're very large concepts. I mean, even I didn't know many of these things until we'd figure these processes out. You just can't. But just imagine everything you're seeing on the screen having, let's say, 10 layers to it, and just peel them back layer by layer by layer, and all of those have a level of prep, a level of decision, a level of post-decision that then has happened even after we filmed. So each layer gets built up like that, and that creates that entire process at the end. Mm-hmm. And we were somewhere kind of feathering the beginning, really heavy in the middle, and then helping to come up with creative solutions towards the end, and hopefully giving the animators enough resources so that those final few layers that they're building up on top have colors that they can play with. I think that's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, obviously, I mean, we want you to go into as much detail as possible. I think most people do, because I think it's like bananas how much work goes into it. Like, for like a shot you would see like a couple of seconds of, to like the whole process that you just laid out, that is an insane amount of work. And it's really interesting to hear how you know, how much goes into just these tiny, tiny little shots that we get.
Well, for example, Yorick, that bit where Yorick comes through and he smashes through all of the... This is season 3, where Yorick comes through, smashes through all of those people as Lyra and Will are trying to escape. So that was 2 days of... This is, again, without any of the prep. So any of the decisions that have been made already. But once we get into shooting, that was 2 days of recceing. So going around the spot, looking at everything. That was, I think, 4 or 5 days of shooting. All of it requiring stunts, requiring, you know, explosives to be put in for squibs. So looking like bullets are pinging off of things. Requiring weather, just waiting for weather. There was windows. There was... puppets running in and out of that. So all of that, and it took like 15, not even 15 seconds, like 10 seconds of screen time, just done, great, that's it. But it takes all of that time to build up all of those things, and then I don't even want to imagine how much time that took afterwards to place Yorick in and make sure that it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to like switch lanes a tiny bit, I'd love, one thing that obviously we've met you a bunch of times, but we've never asked you your journey with the books. Like, had you read them before you came to the series, and have you read them now? What's your journey with them?
What if I just said no? Well, like, just no.
No,
just,
and no. I don't like them. No,
not really so. Bothered about
yeah.
them.
No, I mean, I'm not gonna lie. This is like not my thing. Yeah, ugh. Crap. But no, it's interesting because I've been really interested to find the people that were fan, because I'm from America originally. And I know, I'm sorry. I am now a British citizen, but I am from America originally. And I can't understand how some people knew about it and how some people didn't. I had no idea about these at all, like zero. And to be honest, I think I would have missed a lot of meaning behind certain things. I wouldn't have understood what Oxford was. I would have had an idea. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, we had Harry Potter. I read Harry Potter, but it really didn't make sense. And like now going around Edinburgh, I'm like, oh, like people grew up with this and this is just what it's like. So there's so many cultural references that I don't think I would have even understood. Not to say I wouldn't have enjoyed it, but I wouldn't have had, it wouldn't have felt like home away from home. It would have been a complete magic land from the beginning, which, don't get me wrong, I'm a massive sci-fi and fantasy nerd, like complete through and through, always have. So I don't know how these have slipped my net, but they just had. It really is interesting to meet the Americans who are like, no, I grew up with these. They totally missed me. That being said, I then started hearing about them while I was living, when I first moved over here. I sort of heard people mention them and I was like, because it's a strange thing to hear His Dark Materials when you don't understand they're talking about a book. And so people would say it occasionally and it would just kind of, you know that thing where somebody says something but you don't know what a phrase means, so your brain just goes and then it's gone.
Yeah.
So it would just, that would just sort of happen. And then eventually I was like, oh, and I started reading it. I was like, oh, this is kind of fun. This is, oh, these are kind of nice. And oh, that's a bit spicy, or like, oh, that's a bit like, I'm glad that we're questioning these things, or I'm glad that we're, and I, mm-hmm. it just sort of started interesting me, but I never got through all of them until I got cast. And then I went, right, I'm going to do a deep dive. And I ripped through them really quickly, as you can do. And I kind of am still learning about the world. And every time I go to these, you know, cast things, and they'll ask a really interesting question of, like, you know, Simone about, like, oh, why did you do that? And she'll be like, oh, well, I kind of thought it was like this. And I was imagining that, you know, Mary sort of comes from here, and I'm like, oh, there's more layers. There's more like, there's more. So I haven't gotten sick of imagining new things or thinking from a different character's perspective. And because there's so many characters, you can really spend time. Well, you guys know, you can really spend time enjoying elements of it and sort of building that world in yourself, because so many things are just mm-hmm. not explained, not in a bad way, in a non-condescending way. That's so refreshing to have things, just a world that just exists, and you just have to accept that world exists. You don't have to be walked through, you know, leaf by leaf and know it just exists. So sometimes you're in a place in that world that you just have to understand where you are, and other times you're instantly thrown into another thing that's totally alien, but again, you just, well, look around, and what do you see right around you? That's all you can see about the world. You can't see the entire, you know, world at once. So it's been really fun. I think I've been very lucky to come at it the way that I have, because I was very fresh-faced, really got to fall in love with the characters on my own, in my own way, and have my own relationships with them, rather than what all of my friends might have thought. Or I could have very easily been swayed to feel a certain way about Mrs. Coulter, and now I guarantee I'm coming from it from a very different place than a lot of people will have come from it originally. And I think that's very exciting. That's very exciting for me to have. Mm-hmm. Very special.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I have a similar relationship with the books. I mean, I think even being from the UK and growing up here, it was a big series, and I remember hearing about it when I was a kid, but I think it honestly got buried by Harry Potter and how successful Harry Potter was. So I didn't read them until like a year before me and Rach started the podcast, and Rach grew up with them, but I'd similarly had heard about them, but didn't come to him until I was an adult.
Yeah, it's wild. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think there's something nice about like something that you can find at any point, whether you're a young person and you're starting out and then, whoa, yeah, you're straight into it, or you're an older person. I think that's really cool. That's an interesting series mm-hmm. that can do that. That's a really special sort of body of work that can remain fresh and interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, the fact that I read it as a kid of a similar age to Lyra as she's growing up through the books, and then again as an adult, I feel like I've had vastly different takes. From one thing, when I very first read them, I thought Asriel was just a really cool adventure uncle. And now I'm like, he's the worst person that's ever existed.
I wish he would just accept the fact that this is the thing. Asriel just needs to accept the fact that he's a bit of a nerd, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. You don't have to be hyper-masculine. You can just be a nerd, bro. It's okay. Calm down.
Yeah.
I think it's quite interesting mm-hmm. having it be from... Now, this is a big conversation, but having it from Lyra's perspective, because obviously when Will comes, things sort of start to shift a little bit. But and Daphne and I had some very funny conversations about that when when we just started getting Will in. She was like, why am I not allowed to make decisions anymore? Why am I just always wanting Will to make decisions? And I was like, I don't know, Daphne. I don't know. I mean, maybe this is what you think is supposed to be happening. She was like, no, it's nonsense. I think they found a better middle ground. I think they found a better beginning point than that, because it does feel a bit like that. But it's cool having it be from a female perspective, because this is growing up and starting to understand the world around you. I very much read so many stories and loved stories that were all from male perspectives. And then all of a sudden, I remember I was maybe like, I mean, it's I think some dudes haven't even realized it yet, but you all of a sudden start realizing that those stories and films and you know, theater pieces maybe might not be as interesting to women as they are to us, because they're all, now it's not always the case, but very often it's just dudes, just like being dudes, like around other dudes. And that's fine if you're a dude, because you don't really have to think about it. But then all of a sudden I was like, oh, it's really nice to be put into a different perspective and to have to dress a certain way, not just like the same thing I wear every day, but like, oh no, now I have to dress to impress, you know, all the other people, and I have to do what's right. Whereas so often the stories, you know, boys are just allowed to go off and, you know, Tom Sawyer or whatever, you know, go and be wild. And so it's quite interesting to then come to that. It was a long time before I realized that all the stories about boys might not be as interesting to young women. Yeah, that was a long time.
To be honest, I think even for like us as women, we grew up with those, obviously, like you said, with those same stories, but it was only when I'd gotten a little bit older, I guess I was always like, oh, like there's something missing from these stories. What is it? And then it was only when it was like given to me in like things like Historic Materials and then other things that like amazing like female creators have made, like that I'm like, oh, my perspective on things. I get it now. It's, like, this is what I've been missing.
I know. I really respect Philip for writing from a female perspective. I've really tried, but then I also go, ugh, it's just not hitting right. It's just feeling very strange. It's just, I'm going to leave it to people that have more experience than I will, and I will just read their stories, because I think it's a really important thing to have. And it's obviously happening a lot more now. It is happening a lot more now, and it's being, the issue is being forced. And I think that's a good thing, because it is, oh, it would be such a shame. I talk to my partner all the time, and she's like, yeah, I didn't have a lot of stories that were about women, and not super hardcore, you know, like Wonder Woman, nothing wrong with Wonder Woman, but like, you know, super hardcore heroes, just people that happen to be young girls. It's it'd be important. And I grew up in a family with, like, I was the only dude in a lot of women. So I don't think I would have noticed either reading about girls, but I think it's a good perspective for other people. I don't know where this is going. This is
well, let's bring it back around. We're talking about strong women in literature. And I know that a massive part of your job on this was working with Ruth to really dig down into Mrs. Coulter, one of the best, in our opinion, one of the best women in literature, one of the most complex characters. And I know that a massive part of your job was working with Ruth, was working with a lot of the team to kind of discuss that backstory and figure out the nuance in that character, because that performance from both of you has brought so much more to the character than what we get from the book. And I would love to hear about that process, about how it was working with Ruth, and also any like fun things or not so fun things, it is Mrs. Coulter we're talking about, that you might know about her that you'd like to share, that is your personal headcanon. We can't ask you to claim any kind of canon.
Yeah, no, I definitely wouldn't. I know that Philip has had his opinions about what we've done anyways, and I'm not saying that in a negative way. I'm saying it must have been strange to see sort of this thing that he wrote to be quote unquote pure evil, the Golden Monkey, be a bit more fleshed out. But we had time. We had the time and the space, the visual space, because what he did was he wrote something. And this is the interesting thing, is that things that are written are interpreted, and we interpret them differently than things that we're seeing. So Jane, Joel, Russ, all of them talked very early on. Dan McCulloch, can't forget Dan. They all talked very early on that there are things, all of those creatives that were helping to develop it from the beginning. There are things that you read, that you can read at a single line. Oh, they crest the sky fallen, you know, whatever it is, cloud, and emerge in a wonderland of snow, right? So you can write that in a single line, but then to put that visually, it can take much more time, or you have to add other things that aren't there, because it's allowing your brain to build that world while you're reading. Whereas when you're watching things, it's they're put in front of you. So I think when Ruth and I began working, we knew that there needed to be physical elements that defined our relationship deeper, even if people never saw it, even if it never came up on screen. And a lot of the things that we discussed from the beginning, you will have never seen. There are scenes that I've said this since the beginning, every single scene, I know where Monkey is and she knows where Monkey is and I know where Mrs. Coulter is. So even if we're separated completely, we know where each other are exactly and exactly what we're doing, so that everything that we are doing relates to each other. It doesn't matter if VFX has come to us and said, Brian, no, seriously, we can't see Monkey. I don't want to see any fur. No Monkey. It's like, that's fine. That's totally fine. Okay, why are you on set? Because I'm here so that Ruth knows where I am and that I'm literally here watching her. So we built what I kind of call a playbook or a rule book early on, which I wrote down. I have somewhere. And it literally explains our early physical explorations into how this demon-human relationship would work in terms of what it means when we're close, what it means when we're far apart, what it means when we are in a public space. So I'll start using some of the words that we had built. So we imagined our relationship, our physical relationship, what we could feel connected to each other like a rubber band. The difference is, for most people, with, let's say, Lyra and Pantalaimon, you have a rubber band that's pulling them together. So they feel more comfortable when they're close together. There's no tension. It feels comfortable. It feels how it should feel, natural. And then the further apart they go, that rubber band begins to stretch and it pulls and it gets tighter and it gets less and less comfortable and things become more and more fraught until they come together again and then it's more comfortable again. So that's where most people lie. Now, for many complex reasons, Mrs. Coulter is the opposite. So it's almost like a spring for them. This is season one ideology, season one thought process, because it changes through the seasons. But season one, it's much more like when we see them in their private space, they feel much, much more comfortable when they're far apart. When they have that distance between them, there's space to think, whereas the closer they get, that spring is compressing and compressing and compressing, and all those thoughts start to come up and they might start to experience emotions that they don't want to feel. They might be in a headspace that they don't want to feel, and it just gets tighter and tighter and tighter until it's like a really tight guitar string just ready to snap. The nice thing is about that relationship that we found and that physical feeling of really squeezing it as we got closer is it tends to tighten you up and make you more rigid, which then makes you a perfect look for when you're out in public. So when you're in public, Monkey and Mrs. Coulter are known for being put together, so we would create what's called pretty picture. And that's where Monkey would walk as beautifully as he could next to her in exact sync. I would breathe at the same time as Ruth while we were walking. If her breath changed, I would change my breath. If something affected Monkey, I would change my breath. She would hear it and then change her breath. And we would make these beautiful, pretty pictures walking alongside. And the second that that tension is resolved and we'd get back in that house, it's like we would move away as quickly as possible. So the second you get into that house, you'll notice that Monkey goes straight away off on his own. That's because it's like getting home and taking off your uncomfortable trousers. It's like, whoa, those are really uncomfortable. I'll put on the sweatpants now. You know, it's really finding distance and space from that discomfort. Now, we knew that discomfort meant something, and we knew that it played into their past somehow, and we knew that we had to find a way for that incredibly powerful, strong, incredibly outwardly powerful and strong woman at the beginning to become an incredibly awoken and strong person at the end, who is able to understand their own complex feelings, at least to a degree where they can put them aside to think about somebody else. And that's a big journey to get through. And that was kind of our goal. Since day one, we started thinking forward. I'm not kidding. Our first day in the room reading scripts together, we said, right, here's where we are on day one. By the end of this, the last thing we're going to film, which is the last thing we filmed together, is us being on the precipice, getting ready to sacrifice ourselves for Lyra. So how can we find, over the next 4 years, the difference between where we are now and where we need to get to there? So the entire thing, everything was moving towards that. And it became more organic as we went on. It became much quicker as we went on. Obviously, it's always a little bit uncomfortable to begin with on a purely technical standpoint. Like I said, a big dude crouching next to you at all times in every single shot is a bit strange. But I think after about a week, we got used to it. And we just started to find a flow. And there was never a point when she was on set where I wouldn't be there, even if there were like three other, because sometimes we were triple banking where there were literally three things filming at once, all of them with puppets. And I would sprint over to another set, do a puppet pass really quickly with, let's say, like season three, let's say a Galabaspian or something. Sprint over, do a little Galabaspian pass, and sprint back so I could be there for Ruth so that if she needed anything. And I would be there to get her water. I would be there to, there were plenty of people that did this as well, but I would be there for anything she needed. If she was having a bad day, she could literally come off set and rant to me. If she was having, if she was needing help finding somebody, I could go and help find somebody. So I was essentially like there for lots of various things for her. I wanted to be there as much as possible so that she felt there was always a presence there. And if I wasn't there, there was a reason I wasn't there. So we just built up a beautiful relationship and a lot of trust. And by the end of it, she could just say, I need movements. I'd give her movements. Or she'd say, I don't know what's going on here. What are you doing in this scene? And I would be able to give her my full picture of why I'm doing what I'm doing. And that would help her come to an emotional conclusion. So it became a very back and forth thing. I think it became as much like Mrs. Coulter and Monkey as it could. And there were times that we felt, are we going too far? Are we being a bit schmaltzy? I don't think so. Let's try and just keep true to where we're trying to get to, and then we would just sort of forget about what it might look like and just go for the impact. There were things that got cut out. In season two, there was a scene just after the Lee Scoresby jail scene. We had originally come out. That was obviously a big moment because he calls her out about parents, and this is the first time we sort of hear a bit about the past. We hear a bit about it in season three as well with the dresses coming from her mother, which is like, whoa, what is going on there? Mm-hmm. Yeah, really horrible. Like, yes, well, you need to look proper now, you're back. And we came out of that jail cell, and the blocking that we found together was that she originally started holding the monkey's hand, and then she literally would rip up his hand, so he would essentially go flying into the air. She'd grab him by the back of the neck, and she literally smashed him against the wall like two or three times. And it was really, really upsetting. But I think you can still feel it in the scene, but it got cut out because it was basically too much. It was like, it was really intense. And the first time we did it, Monkey broke. So she ripped up Monkey, smashed him against the wall, and his arm went flying. And she has the most incredible reaction because that is then still totally acting, but all of a sudden this like rage is getting colored by this fear and this like oh, what have I done instantly. But she was able to hold on to it and kept going. And then she came to me after the scene and she was like, I'm really, did I break monkey? And I was like, yeah, you broke Monkey. And she was like, is it fixable? And I was like, yeah, of course it's fixable, don't worry, just keep doing what you're doing, it doesn't matter, because it just gave a really nice thing. Now that's the kind of thing where we would experiment with extremes, and sometimes those extremes are too far, you know, sometimes they are. But I think that emotion, that extreme that we had found still came out in the way that she comes out, goes and stands against the wall, which again is something like, duh, that's a really weird reaction to have, just, you know, being told to stand in a corner against a wall and then leaving. So it just became... it became this strange thing. And by season three, all the directors knew that we had that relationship, and they had been told in advance, Brian's going to always be there. He can always help you with anything as well. If you need something, he can help go and get that done, or you know, discuss that with people. Because I was a sort of middle ground a lot of the times. And when things are getting really stressful and really tense, I was a safe person that everyone, Daphne, Will, both Wills, as in I'm talking about Amir, Will, anyone, if they're having a bad day, I can go and speak to them. They know who I am. They know that they can react however they want with me without being worried about having a negative response to it. So yeah, it just became, now, is there anything that I can tell you about my headcanon?
I don't know if this is something you, I'm surely it's something you spoke about. The Masriel of it all. Did you have conversations with Ruth about what the fuck she sees in Asriel, or about that tension between them, about how Monkey and Stell interact? Our main question through this whole thing
I think we've definitely tried to figure it out. I don't think it's ever something you can figure out, because a lot, this is the funny thing, is that, you know, I've been asked as well, like, oh, what do you think this means? Or like, what do you think that the history is? And I don't always say, because I feel sometimes it's better if people take from it what they want. But I'll tell you what we kind of discussed. I think there's always going to be something interesting about danger. We, even the most even-footed of us enjoys something different. I think you could read a lot of things into it. Is there a trauma in her past, which then means she's more attracted to a certain level of disregard? Is there just literally a physical sexual attraction that is there? I mean, yes, there's obviously between Stell and Monkey, there is it, sort of the first thing that you see is an animal magnetism between them. A want to be physically close to each other. Interestingly, Amber, who puppeteers Stell, we would discuss this before scenes because we didn't want to make it too much, but we would kind of say, well, what, you know, you're kind of watching me. That in the scene where, in this is season three, in the scene where Asriel basically physically abuses and fully abuses Mrs. Coulter, there is a separate scene which was filmed of what Stell and Monkey are doing that entire time. So Charles, the director, we worked an entire scene through with him, which then got cut, which I think is actually good because it was much more interesting keeping to what Asriel and Mrs. Coulter are doing. But there is, in the background, behind the airship, where you can't quite see them behind the tools, Stell and Monkey. Stell essentially pacing around the monkey. Sorry, I forget, people can't see what I'm doing. Stell stalking around the monkey, and then by the end of it, coming into the monkey to seek forgiveness or comfort, physical comfort, which the monkey literally just sits there staring forward the entire time. The entire time of that scene, Monkey is just sitting, staring forward, not paying attention to Stell at all. So there's some real trauma going on there. But I think also, even if it was just a purely sexual relationship, which when you're young, a sexual relationship can do crazy things. Also, if this relationship that she was in before was to Edward, was Edward, that's his name, isn't it? Edward, I think it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If that then was something that was forced by the family, which I don't think she has a good relationship with her family. If that was a forced thing, then you do whatever you could to get as far away from that as possible. And if that's the crazy cuckoo scientist bad boy, then, you know, great. Then your family gets rid of you and you can go and do what you want to do. But also, she does have a child with him. And I think she remembers more than he does for a lot of it, which also kind of is something we see quite often, is that the mother has had this child. She never forgets about Lyra, ever. She never stops thinking about her. She does say, and I do truly believe, that she has done what she thinks is best for Lyra, no matter how extreme it is, because she is a woman of extremes. I mean, she is a woman of extremes. She wants something and she goes for it with every ounce of her being. And I think that then creates a very strange void where he still has a part in her life. And maybe that is what's best, is for him to still have a part in her life. Or at least she could learn from him. She, you know, as in Lyra, can definitely learn from him if he weren't such a fricking poo. And I don't know.
We agree.
I think it's, yeah, it's an interesting relationship, but I'm glad that it exists because it is unashamedly horrible and it's not healthy at all. And there's nothing, I don't believe there's anything healthy about it. And I don't believe there's anything healthy about him, even to the end. But, you know,
So there is one thing that we wanted to ask you, and I mean, we've got a bunch more questions, but I wanted to get this in. A lot of people have asked us to ask you. It was also high up on our list. We asked Russell about this, and he claims he doesn't remember. But so we read an article recently that said, I think it was an interview with Ruth. She said that the monkey spoke in season 3. Did the monkey speak in season 3? If so, can you tell us when it was and what he said?
So,
are you allowed?
Yeah, I'm sure I'm allowed. I think I don't know. This is an interesting one. This is one of the, I think, only times in my life that I haven't let my ego get in the way of the art. And by that I mean, it's so easy to go, I know I'm supposed to speak in book 3. I know I'm supposed to speak in book 3. I just want the ability to speak in book 3. I just want to say one line. I just want one line. And I'd been talking with them and, you know, with Jack and all the writers about what it could be, Sophie, etc. You know, all through what it could be, what it could be, what it could be. And then in season 3, someone went, oh, you read the new script? And I was like, nope. And they were like, monkey's got that line. And I was like, oh, right, monkey's got a line. And I read it and I was like, huh, okay, well, that's interesting. Do you remember what he says in the book?
In the book, it's very much a throwaway. I think they are wandering through somewhere. They're wandering through the Adamant Tower at some point, and it's literally just a, hey, look over there. Or I wonder what that is.
Literally. And Ruth asked Philip why he had Monkey saying that, and Philip went, no, Monkey doesn't say anything. And she's like, no, he definitely does. He was like, no, Monkey doesn't say anything. And then she showed it to him, and he was like, oh, whoops. So I don't know what that means. I quite like the idea that, I don't know what that means. But there was a line that was written for season 3. I will tell you the scene that it was in. It was when Ogunwe and Mrs. Coulter are talking in where the airship goes, in the hangar. Everyone, including Ruth, was like, yeah, it's time for your line. We're going to get you all mic'd up. So they got me all mic'd up, and we got to doing the scene. And first of all, I have to say really quickly as a sideline, Adewale is one of my favorite actors in the entire world. And I didn't tell him on the show. I'm sure he won't hear this, but I didn't tell him on the show because I just didn't want to
send him this clip,
ruin it. I was like, oh, I don't know. This is like one of my favorite actors of like all time. And I'm working with Adewale. This is amazing. And then we got to that scene and I had this line. Literally the entire script crew came down. They were watching us film it. We were doing the shot of Monkey, and it got time for me to say my line. And it's a very quiet scene, but it's very thoughtful and very touching between Ogunwe and Mrs. Coulter. It's basically two parents not having to say anything, but knowing exactly what each other are saying. So it gets time for Monkey to say something. And I just look up at Ruth, and she kind of looks at Monkey, but also kind of looks at me. And I just went and just shook my head really quietly. And she looked over at Ogunwe, as in Adewale, and he just went, all right, and carried on with the scene. And we did it again, and I stayed quiet again. And we did it a third time, and I stayed quiet a third time. And then the script crew literally went to the director and was like, what's going on? Is Monkey going to say his line? And they came to me and they were like, are you not going to say your line? And I was like, I'm not going to say my line. And they were like, what do you mean? And I was like, I'm not going to say the line. I think it's being said. And Ruth just basically said, I think everything has been said that needs to be said. I don't think we need to have that line. And then Adewale was like, yeah, I think it feels really nice. And they were like, okay, all right, fine. And they all sort of left. And I think I kind of upset people a little bit because obviously, you know, it would be the chance. Partially, it's because that many years we've all been working together. I think it would have been a chance for me to actually use my voice and voice the monkey. And it just wasn't right. I think it was the silence spoke really, really, really well in that scene. And it just was right just not to say anything. And they both looked to me. I mean, in the scene, they both looked to monkey and he doesn't say anything. Now, after that, right after that scene, we ended up filming in the little mine shaft. We ended up doing the scene where she has to go and ask forgiveness for to Monkey. And that was then incredibly emotionally raw afterwards. So I think we made the right decision on the day. It was a big day. It was a complex day for Ruth and I. And it was just in the moment. And I was all mic'd up and everything. And literally sound people were waiting. And I just knew it wasn't right. So I just didn't. And it's kind of heartbreaking. I don't know, but I think it was just right, you know.
Yes, I think it was. Thank you, because I honestly think it was the right choice.
The energy that was there on the day, it was so nice. And you know, they were hardly saying anything to each other anyway. So I think there was the moment on the day. Everyone was really excited. I mean, literally, the entire crew was excited for it, and I just knew it wasn't right, so I didn't do it. And I don't know if I'll regret that. And I don't know. I think it's always going to be one of those things that I feel bittersweet about. Yeah. But I think it was just it was the correct decision. And I think I'm very grateful for them for actually pushing through a line. I don't know if it would have made it to the cut anyways. But I think it's just I think Russ probably was grateful, because I don't know if they had the monkey rigged for speaking or not. Oh, they must have, because he's Screech as well. Not necessarily. Russ probably was grateful either way. He was probably like, oh, thanks, Brian. Yes, fight in our corner. But no, it was.
We asked him and he said, oh, I don't think I was there that day. Or if I was, I don't remember it. And also, I have a feeling that if it was there and I was there, I would have said, oh, that doesn't sound right. And we said, yeah, fair enough. Mm-hmm. And so I think you had the exact same instinct.
I think correctly.
And
considering it's basically like that, Ruth, Russ and I, now this is not including all of the animators that work on Monkey. I'm not excluding them at all. But in terms of those like on-set conversations, Ruth, Russ and I are Monkey, if you know what I mean. It's like, we couldn't do it without one or the other. So yeah. I think it's right that all of us felt that way. Mm-hmm. And yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
So I would love to ask you, I remember when Rich and I first watched the first two episodes and you messaged us, being like, I had a broken arm in this scene and I went to hospital. It'd be great if you could tell us about that, because we've been dying to hear that story.
So yes, this is my season 3 trauma. Mm-hmm. Everything going so well. Season 3, Brian, knowing it's going to be a really tough season, so I'm going to get ahead of myself. I'm going to be really healthy this season. I'm going to cycle into work. I was living, you know, like a 10-minute cycle up the road, really easy cycle, literally a straight line down a hill. That will be really great. And the day that we were, so York rescuing the bear, so in the York at the docks, big stunt scene with lots of extras and stunt people all getting bashed around by York. So I was cycling to work to get a bus to go and go and rehearse and then film, was quite literally around the corner from the studios, and don't remember what happened, and then was on the ground. And there was a car speeding around me. And I remember thinking, I think I've just been hit by a car. And I sort of scrambled off to the side of the road. It wasn't dark. This is like, you know, summer. So it was very bright. And I kind of scraped myself off the road, kind of checked how I was doing. My entire backpack had been dragged through. I had, you know, road burn all down my back. But I thought, okay, that's all right. And then I looked down at my arm and my wrist sort of looked like I had dislocated it. So I thought, oh, that's not going to be good for a puppeteer, but I think it's just dislocated. I'd always been told if you can wiggle your fingers, that's good. So I wiggled my fingers and I was like, okay, yeah, they're wiggling, fine. So I called Elliot up, Elliot being the other one of the other heads of the department, and he was in the workshop, and I said, I think I've just been hit by a car. Can you get the medics to come and see me? He was like, yeah, no worries, man. Yeah, no worries. He hangs up. I hang out on the side of the road, not knowing what's going on. Like 15 minutes later, the medics show up, and the medic basically takes one look at me and is like, we need to go to the hospital now. I get put in the car. I'm starting to come out of shock. I get rushed to the hospital. Olivia, one of the other people on the team, is trying to follow behind. She goes into the wrong entrance. I go into the emergency entrance because I've been hit by a car at 40 plus miles an hour, and I don't remember it. So they take me into the recess room, make sure I'm not going to die. They start checking me out. Olivia, meanwhile, is in the main reception, and they have no note of me. So she thinks I'm dead, literally. She thinks I'm dead at this point. They put me on gas and air and say the pain should be receding now, and I say it's not. I had six women in the room with me, all looking after me, and I said, if this is how you give birth with just gas and air, y'all are amazing, to which they all laughed. And then they finally came back in after giving me like this x-ray, and they said, on a scale of 1 to 10, this is about an 8 or a 9 in terms of severity. So we can't class it as a break. It's classed as an explosion. You've exploded your arm.
Oh my God.
We're scheduling you in for surgery. And we need to give you MRIs and everything else right now and make sure you don't have any other internal injuries. So I say, okay, are you putting me on pain meds? They were like, yes. And I said, can you give me 15 minutes to call my team? And they said, no. And I said, okay, I'll call them on the way. So I call my team on the way in. Olivia, beside herself, thinking I'm dead. This is like an hour later. I give them instructions for the day. Elliot has to rush out and go and do Yorick, which he's very good at anyways, and he was a great person for it, so they were fine. I go in, I get my arm reset. I don't remember any of this. I'm on morphine at this point. A couple hours later, I get one of the production runners to come and pick me up. He's driving me home, and I say, right, can we go into the studios? And he was like, no, Brian, your arm is black and you look horrible. And I was like, no, I need to go into studios. He's like, Brian, no. And I was like, yes, we have to go into studios now. So I go into studios and I spend about an hour at studios getting everything sorted with a broken arm. Hasn't been reset. It hasn't been surgery or anything yet. At which point Dan McCulloch comes down and says, number one, I need a picture for Jane because she's worried you're dead. And number two, you have to go home. And I was like, Dan, I've just got a couple more things to do. And he was like, Brian, you have to go home now. And I was like, okay. So I left, had surgery the next day. And yeah, for the next, the rest of the shoot, basically, I had a broken arm. So I was in a cast. All of those scenes on the cliffs where Lyra's running around the cliffs and monkeys running around in the chapel and everything. I have a full cast on for that. One of those days, I started feeling a bit ill because I was running around on these cliffs all day with a broken arm puppeteering. I just started to feel a bit bad and then found out I had compression, so the cast was cutting off circulation. Then I had to go back to the hospital because I turned green. And yeah, it was all great fun. It was great fun. It was really good fun. It was good for everyone to make fun of me, though. Everyone enjoyed that a lot.
Oh my God, Brian.
When you said, oh, I had a broken arm for this, I was not anticipating.
Oh yeah, I have like an 8-9 inch plate running. I don't have a wrist anymore.
Oh my God.
Oh, whoa.
Brian. Oh my God. And was it like a hit and run? Did the car just leave?
Do you know what South Wales Police says? I called them up because I have to report it. And I said, there's lots of CCTV. It's an industrial estate sort of area. And they said, okay, well, we're not going to investigate unless it has life-changing injuries or you die. So unless I was fully paralyzed or I died, they refused to investigate. And I said, why is that? And they said, because we have too many. So yeah, be careful on your bikes, everyone. It's yeah, it was interesting. It was certainly interesting. But it's all right, because, Joel got appendicitis during the show, really serious appendicitis, almost died. Russ then was like, oh, I'm not feeling too good. I wonder if I have appendicitis. He got appendicitis. He was really serious. In Boreal's place, there's two little appendixes that one, they're both modeled off of Russ and Joel's little appendixes.
Oh my god.
I got my broken arm and almost died. So I thought, well, that works. That's, you know.
Oh my god. That is much worse than I thought it was going to be.
It was pretty bad. Also, my favorite part of the whole thing is that the surgeon didn't realize, he knew it was bad. And when the first thing I remember after coming out of anesthesia after the surgery, is he said, well, Brian, it was worse than we thought. It was like a bag of gravel. I was like, that's not what you want to hear in a strong Welsh accent when you're coming out of a surgery, like a bag of gravel.
Oh, so, my God.
Yeah. Apologies to the squeamish listeners. It's horrible.
God. I know that you mentioned that Ruth accidentally broke Monkey on set. Are there any other occasions upon which you had to do a very rapid puppet fix after a particularly eventful shoot?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the puppets all got kind of a harsh time. When we were earlier on in the seasons, all of the young people were even younger, so they were pretty rough on the puppets. But that was good because we wanted them to have a relationship with them anyways. So it was kind of like, well, don't worry, we'll just glue them back together if something happens. It's not a big deal. And then as you go on, I mean, a lot of the demons the little Gallivespians were interesting because they were little, we 3D printed little men and women, and turned them into little molds. And then Hester painstakingly made little wire skeletons for them that then we put foam on so that we could pose them in all sorts of positions, and they had little magnets in their feet so we could stick them up in weird places and they would just stand there. Those ended up getting dropped and smashed and squished and bent in all kinds of horrific positions. I'll let your imagination take you to those places.
I'm just imagining Lord Roke when he's splattered on the floor like a fly.
oh. To be fair, Will Keen got, because that's how we did it, is we gave him, I puppeteered one of those little things into his hand, or Sara did. I think both Sara and I did it at different times, because it was if I was puppeteering Monkey or not. Anyways, we gave him one of those little squishy things so he could properly mash it and then throw it as hard as he could against the window. And every time Roke was in a really upsetting position, like really, really upsetting position. And it made them laugh too much every time. It was, he was messed up. If you want to see something really disturbing, then look up Framestore's VFX reference for the Gallivespians, because in the first like 5 seconds, you'll see me, because I was the original test person for the Gallivespians. So you'll see me with like slicked hair and ooh, it's a real look. I don't know. Puppets always break, especially these kind of puppets. Things happen all the time. Monkey's arms were always coming off, or not too many at bad times, but you know, sometimes Pan would be sort of like running across Lyra and like the head would pop off and it would look a bit disturbing. But I think they held on pretty well. The puppet that people have seen me out puppeteering, most of the puppets that people have seen us puppeteering with are the ones that we used on set. So some people thought we made like different special ones so that we didn't use the on-set ones. No, the ones that people were interacting with and shaking their hands and getting to feel how it felt, those are all the real ones that we used on set. So they were pretty robust builds, all things considered. And they were all built so that if anything broke, we could fix it as quickly as possible off-set. I mean, there were some real panicky moments, but the worst one was all of the windows. So in order to get the windows cut for when Will has to cut windows, we used fishing line. We used this much more when he first started using the knife because he had to get the muscle memory of what it felt like to actually touch against something, try and find a specific wire, and then cut along it. But when we first started using it, it was in Chittagatse, which was obviously a beautiful set. But in Chittagatse, it was all like 12-foot tall beams that we had to hide out of shot with these like single fishing lines coming down, which are clear so that they could get rid of them really easily. But it meant that people were constantly like walking into them or like backing into them, or and then you have to go up and you have to restring this single fishing line again. It was oh my god, they were horrible. Or like Amir would just be like, oh, how much will it take to break? And you'd be like, no, Amir. And he'd be like, oh, sorry, man, sorry.
Oh, sweet baby.
And then Daphne would be like, what did you do last time? What, did you do this? And you'd be like, Daphne, no. And they would just literally be pissing themselves, just having the best time. No, please. But other than that, I think they were okay. In terms of most robust and most used puppet, I think one of the most used, which is it kind of ended up becoming a joke and then became quite serious at the end, is whenever we made windows, we had to set up a little aluminium. See that? I did that so that all you guys over here would understand.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
I had to set up an aluminium wire, man. So we had to set up these aluminium wires in a shape of a window, whatever shape he had cut or whatever shape we wanted it to be, so that they understood where they had to step over, so that they understood where to squeeze in between, so that we could make sure that their backpacks weren't just going to get like cut in half as they were going through the world or whatever. And we just threw one together really quickly during end of season one. And then that one lasted through all of the seasons, and we would constantly take it down and then rewrap it into like a little coil and then get it back out and put it back up. And we used this exact same window through all of the seasons for almost every single one of the window shots. And it became like this weird, sacred bit of kit. It was like nobody touched that. Everyone was like, whoa, don't touch that. That's been here since the beginning, man. That's like one of the original. It was really weird. It became this super strange thing, but it was like a... like who can make the window look the nicest without any crinkles in it, and who can, yeah, I don't know. It's the weird things that you get into when you've been filming for that long. It's, you get really sentimentally attached to the strangest things. Mm-hmm. I've kept my little rod. I have a single rod. I built lots of rods for Monkey, but mm-hmm. I ended up using one, which is this weird, it comes out at an L where it connects to his wrist. And then it comes up at like a weird sort of skew-if bendy angle, and then it's got a little like flat paddle thing at the top, which just worked really nicely in my hand, and it was the perfect length. So I ended up using that, and that was the single rod that I used pretty much for both puppets, the earlier version of the Monkey and then the later one. So I've kept that little rod to myself. It's just it looks like nothing. It looks like a bit of junk, but I've used that in every single shot with Monkey, so that I've kept for myself.
Very sentimental. I love it. So we will wrap up shortly, but we have like three kind of like quick-ish questions that we ask everyone. But before we do that, I would love to ask you, like, if there's anything that we haven't asked you that you would like to talk about, or any story, other stories that you have that you want to put out into the world, anything that else you want to say, feel free to say it now.
Oh, it's so hard. There are so many, you know, even thinking back on it, I think people start to go, oh yeah, you remember this memory or you remember that memory. It's like, oh yeah. I mean, we did everything from sweating with scorpions in Spain to like tramping all over the roof of Oxford, like literally just climbing up and over the roofs, like the highest point of the roofs. There was one time when we had to get over and nobody told me that there was this really easy path to get through. And this dude was like, oh yeah, just climb over the roof. And I was like, what? The actual like roof. And I climbed all the way up on the tallest part of this roof. Like, this is a massively steep thing. That's just, it was the sketchiest thing I've ever done. And I was like, I guess this is just what we do here. And then everyone else was walking around the outside like, what are you doing up there, Brian?
Like, why is Brian on the roof?
Why is Brian 20 feet up? I didn't break my arm there, though, did I? No, I broke my arm 2 feet away from studios. I don't know. There are just too many stories. There are too many memories. I mean, I don't know. I'll just keep doing conventions for the rest of my life and then just telling more and more stories as it goes on. Just how long-winded can I get over time?
Yes.
Yes. I'll just try and get more and more long-winded.
Just send us a voice note every time you think of something. Like, oh, this one time.
Oh, yeah, this one time. And then like 6 hours later, you guys would be like, God, can we stop listening to this voice note now? It hasn't stopped. I didn't even think they could go on this long.
No, we'd always welcome a voice note from you, Brian. So don't worry about that.
The secrets. Well, I'm working on a little... there's something that I have to make for Daphne right now, which she's been asking since season one, which I've been putting off since season one. Season one, some of the puppeteers might have exaggerated how well I could do impressions, because I was going around and doing impressions of everyone on set. Not nasty, by the way. Let me just say, these are like, I never want to be nasty, and I never want to be a nasty person. So these were like things that people enjoy about themselves, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And then she was like, well, I want to see my impression of me. And I was like, Daphne, I really don't want to do an impression of you. I really don't want to. And she was like, no, you have to. And I was like, okay, I'll do it at the rap party. And then I didn't do it at the rap party because, you know, she was young, so disappeared early. And I was like, yes, got out of that one. And then all of season two, she was like, I want to see that impression of me. And I was like, oh, no, okay, all right. Well, wait until rap again. She's like, okay. Well, long story short, I still haven't done it, but I reckon now I just have to make, like, a really high quality, I don't know, Oscar-worthy short, which is just a, like, super high quality Daphne impersonation. I don't know. I'm like, Daphne, no, don't make me do this. I just never want to hurt somebody's feelings. It's never meant to be. What if it does, though? Oh, that would be heartbreaking.
I'm sure it won't hurt her feelings. If she's so adamant on wanting you to do it.
That's the worst. Oh, no. Oh, God. I'll do it eventually. It will happen. It will happen, and it will be glorious, and it will be beautiful, and she'll absolutely love it. And then she'll get me in on her next project, puppeteer with her. We tried to get that on this project that she's on right now. I told her she should tell the execs that it was a non-negotiable. She had to have like Brian the puppeteer with her at all times. Apparently it didn't fly. She tried though.
Well.
Do you have just like somewhat quick fire, like a top three moments of like your favorite things across the filming process, whether it be things once you've seen them on screen or like things that have happened while you've been doing it, like a top three for us?
I really liked the first day that we were filming at all, Ruth and I, which was in Oxford, and she said she might quit that day. So I really enjoyed that day because it was really hard. And I knew that if we could get through that day, we get through anything. And we did. No, there's honestly too many. I mean, you know, it's so hard to explain, but when you're on set every single day, and I mean every single day, there's just so many things. My brain instantly like explodes with memories and ideas and things. I mean, I think every single day was something quite special, genuinely. So, yeah.
That's fair.
Yeah, I did love disappointing Daphne because she was like, why can't the monkey and Lyra just have that final hand-holding moment? And I was like, no, I'm never gonna let you have it. She was like, no, but let me hold the puppet's hand. And I was like, no, I'm not gonna let you have it. And she didn't. So I think it's little things like that. It's just things that where you the real and the art crosses mm-hmm. over for a quick mm-hmm. moment. Those are really special moments.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, final three quick questions. Number one, if you had a demon, what would your demon be? What type of animal would it be?
You know, for 4 or 5 years of this, I still haven't come up with a good answer. Everyone else has a good answer by now. I've always thought, I wonder if I'm in the world, like in Will's world, basically, where I don't have a visible demon. So I think it would surprise me. Whatever it is, I think I could say, oh, it would be a bear, or it would be mm-hmm. like a lemur or something. But I think it would surprise me. I don't think I come across the way that I think I do, if you know what I mean. I think it would surprise mm-hmm. me. So I don't know. I'm going to say I'm in Will's world and I haven't yet discovered it, or I haven't seen it physically.
That's a great answer. We haven't had that answer before. That's a really good answer.
Yes.
Other question that we always ask is, if you had the alethiometer, what would you ask it?
It's tough because it likes direct questions. It doesn't like... Mm-hmm. metaphorical questions. It likes direct questions. So maybe something direct. what's the next job that I should bother somebody on? Because that's pretty direct, and that will give me at least something interesting, a direction to go into. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love that, because that's how you came across this. So it's like, you exactly. need to know what your next chance yeah. you have to take is. Yeah.
Who should I bother next?
Yeah. Okay, and last one. If you had the subtle knife, what type of world would you want to cut through?
Again,
to?
I feel like I'm... It's not fair. I feel so contrary, but I feel like I would know it when I felt it. If I had the subtle knife and I were able to use the subtle knife, I think I would just move around through those strings of worlds until I found something that felt right. I don't know what that would be. I guess I'd like it to be peaceful, but who knows what I need. The subtle knife would tell me more than I would know, I think.
Yeah, that is true.
I love those answers.
Yeah, great answers, Brian.
I don't want them to sound really wanky.
I know. I think you might have beat Lynn for the best knife answer, actually, to be fair.
Oh, careful. Oh, no. Lynn, no, don't do it. Don't put me against Lynn. No, his followers will kill me. No, Lynn's followers. I'm sorry. No.
Well, Brian, it's been an absolute pleasure. And also, before we let you go, we just want to say, obviously, season 3 is done. But we have really loved getting to know you over the span of the series, and you're such a huge supporter of the podcast. So thank you so much for just always being a great supporter of us and always being a friendly face when we go to these different events, because we always love seeing you.
It's always so nice when I'm, because the thing is I'm not super comfortable at these things. I enjoy them, and I enjoy it once I'm in there and doing my job. But if I'm not there doing my job, it's really nice to see friends, and that is definitely what you guys are. So it's just been really nice over the years. I was really glad when I was actually looking through the emails to find this link, and then I found the email from the first one that you guys wrote to me, and I was like, oh yeah, that was really exciting, because it is exciting when people ask and want to know more, and I just love what you guys do. I do. I like the angles that you go with. I like the depth. I like the fan base. I like the people that engage with it. I like going out and speaking to other people that have listened to it as well. By the way, was out in North Berwick recently, and there's a massive HDM following up there, and they've listened to your podcast. So you didn't know you had fans up in North Berwick, but you do.
Hey, North Berwick!
So, yeah, what's up, North Berwick? Yeah, it was really nice. But it's always been great fun, and I like that. I don't think you'd have the people coming on if you weren't like great fun anyways. And it's not just about being fun. I understand that, but you are good people who do really, really cool stuff. So thanks so much for having me. Cause it really is fun. It is genuinely fun. Like, I look forward to this a lot.
Yeah. Oh, well, I hope we lived up to your expectations. I know there's so much more that you could say. And honestly, when we say anytime that you want to come back on and tell us any more stories, do it.
Same goes. If other people send in more crazy questions, like, I love it. I love where people's brains go. It's awesome. I just feel bad that like 5 minutes you guys talked and then like, what, an hour and 30 minutes. See, this is what everyone doesn't have to listen to. They're going to have to go back and listen to this, everyone, and then edit it and get rid of all the crap that I said and make it sound like I'm not just blathering on for a long time, but I am. And they have to listen to that. That's why they're so good.
That's what's the most fun. We get to like, I just edited the interview we did with Simone last night. I edited it and it was so much fun. I was smiling the whole time because you can't listen to Simone and not smile. And it was like reliving it. And that's what's really sad about this third season. It's the final season that it's done. So I'm also having a little cry because I'm like, is this the last time I'll get to speak with Simone? It will not be the last time we speak with you, Brian. It won't be.
No, good. You have me back on. Don't worry. I'll keep coming on. Forever and ever and ever.
Yes, please. Honestly, thank you so much again. Honestly, this has been so fun.
Thank you.
A pleasure, as always.
Wow.
Oh. Thank you so much, Brian. We love you.
We do love you. We do love you. We hope you all enjoyed that interview with Brian. It was such a joy to talk to him. And we can't wait to just be pals with Brian.
Yeah, and a great big special shout out to Thistle the dog, because
Thistle the dog. Oh,
she's so cute.
Dog.
We love it when people bring their pets to their interviews.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, Thistle. Yeah. It was so great to talk to Brian.
It was. We could easily have spent another 2 hours talking, but I think we were all pretty enthusiastically tired by the end of that. So,
absolutely. Yes. Yeah, 100%. And just a reminder, we said it in the intro, but we'll say it again. We have not disappeared forever. We are going to do episode 8 of the TV show when everything calms down for us, and then we'll be back into the book episodes. Can't give you dates just yet, but when we can, we will let you know.
Yes, we will. We will return with our thoughts on that final episode. It is hilarious that it's a devastating episode. And it feels like we're just avoiding it and putting it off because it's difficult. And yes, that's partly why.
Part of it. It is part of it, yeah.
Yeah.
But we will get there. Thank you for being patient with us. And yeah, we hope you rejoin us on the journey when we get there, which will hopefully be sooner rather than later.
Yeah. In the meantime, just go back and listen to this interview again and all the other interviews again to listen to all those lovely voices.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Her Dark Materials. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at HDMPod. And you can email us at herdarkmaterialspod@gmail.com. You can also visit our website at hdmpod.co.uk.
If you want to support us, you can become a patron at patreon.com/HDMPod. We also have a shop where you can buy merch featuring all original artwork from Rich. You can find it at hdmpod.co.uk/shop. I'm Faye, and when I'm not talking to Brian, you can find me talking about Paramore on my other podcast, Still Into You. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts and find us on Twitter and Instagram at Still Into You Pod.
I'm Rachel, and when I'm not here chatting to you lovely folks and Brian about puppets and cool puppet stuff, I'm making cute and magical arty things. You can find me over on Instagram at RachMakes, on Twitter and TikTok at Rach_makes, and over on my online shop, rachmakes.co.uk. A huge thanks, as always, to Johnny Knott for his musical stylings. And a huge, huge thank you to Brian and Thistle for their time.
Yay! And we'll see you soon, and don't forget,
keep telling stories,
and all will be well.